dread spot along with the sea surface temperature of the Gulf Stream. And while these are certainly different fluids on different planets, certainly, they do share some small characteristics. In particular, we have also present in both of these pictures.
So my work deals mostly with ocean dynamics. And ocean dynamics are on the large scale side of things and relatively slow. So the flows I work with are on the order of, say, 100 kilometers and moving at a velocity of on the order of, say, 0.1 meters per second. So at this length scale, the rotation rate of the Earth becomes important, the rotation of the Earth becomes important. And this is encoded in the Coriolis force. A mathematical model which is really good at describing these large scale motions is known as quasi-geostrophy. But what I want to talk to you about is surface quasi-geostrophy. And this is sort of a different twist on the QG equations, in which we assume that all motion is driven by surface temperature, heating, and heating at the surface there. So I'm going to talk to you about the mathematical models we use. So these are the non-dimensionalized primitive equations. I have a non-dimensional number there, the Rossby number, RO. And it's very important for my work, and I'm going to talk about it in a little more detail on the next slide. U is the three-dimensional velocity field. We have a nonlinear advection term, u dot grad u. The Coriolis force is encoded in the f cross u term. Pressure is the gradient of p term. And finally, we have buoyancy, which we note only acts in the z direction, is the b term. The next equation we have is the incompressibility condition. And this basically stipulates that our velocity field is divergence free. And finally, we have a thermodynamics equation, which basically tells us how the buoyancy field evolves in time. So in particular, we see that there is the same sort of almost nonlinear term as in the first equation. The buoyancy is advected around by the background velocity. And we also have an extra contribution from the vertical velocity W, and it's scaled by L over LD. So L is the characteristic length, LD is the deformation radius, and I'll explain what that is now. So use the three-dimensional velocity. The Rossby number is defined as U over FL. U and L are characteristic velocities and length scales, and F is the Coriolis parameter. LD, the deformation radius, is defined as NH over F, H being the depth of the fluid. And N is a parameter which is related to the background stratification, but for our purposes, we're just going to take this as constant. So in order to get from the primitive equations to the QG model, we make a certain set of assumptions. So first, the Rossby number, which is the ratio of advection to rotation, we assume that this value is very small, much smaller than 1. And in particular, what this means is that the rotation force dominates the local advection of fluid. We assume that the length scale, the horizontal length scale, is comparable to the deformation radius, which is using typical ocean parameters. This is about 100 kilometers. And finally, we assume that the horizontal length scale is much larger than the depth. And this gives us shallow water along with hydrostatic balance. So you do an asymptotic expansion with small parameter Rossby number, and you find that at leading order, your flow is described by these two equations. So in the interior of the fluid, we have a quantity Q, which is advected by the background velocity. And here I should also mention that the background velocity here is now two-dimensional. By using these assumptions, basically the vertical velocity becomes zero. And at vertical boundaries, we find that the buoyancy is similarly advected by the background velocity. So Q is the QG potential vorticity, and it's defined in terms of a new function here that I've written as psi. So this function psi is the stream function. It's a very convenient kind of tool in fluid dynamics. If you have a two-dimensional fluid, you can write everything in terms of a stream function, and then you can get your horizontal velocity fields via horizontal derivatives. And due to the assumption of shallow water, we have hydrostatic balance, which gives us a relation between the buoyancy field along with the vertical derivative of the stream function. Okay, so in order to get to the SQG setup, we set the interior potential vorticity to equal to zero. And at the surface of the ocean, we assume we have some given buoyancy distribution, BT. And if we assume doubly periodic horizontal boundary conditions, we find that we can get an analytic solution in Fourier space for the stream function. So basically what this equation tells us is that basically everything is decaying exponentially down. And so K here refers to horizontal wave numbers. And so kind of a little bit more about this equation, it tells us that large-scale features, which are encoded in small k, are decaying slower than the small-scale features, which are encoded in large k. So this is great. We have an exact solution for the vertical profile, which means that we only have to solve how the buoyancy field at the surface is evolving. And once we have that, we can project down to whatever depth we want using the string function definition here. OK, so in case that was a little bit too much math for you, this is kind of the basics of what I just talked about. So we have two mathematical models for ocean dynamics. We've got the primitive equations, which are three-dimensional. They're nonlinear, and they're also very expensive to solve. But they are very accurate in predicting ocean dynamics. On the flip side, we have QG and SQG. And these are two-dimensional. They're easy to solve. However, they are approximations to the primitive equations. And so some dynamics which exist in the primitive equations won't be present in the QG and SQG approximation. And so what my research aims to answer is, when are the SQG equations accurate for ocean dynamics? To answer this, we turn to numerical models. We have two numerical models that we use, QG3, which was written by Glenn Fliero at MIT for SQG dynamics. And we have the second model, SPINS, which is the spectral parallel incompressible Navier-Stokes solver. And this, among other things, can solve the primitive equations. So SPINS was written by a former PhD student at Waterloo, Christopher Subic, who has graduated a couple years ago. Both of these models use identical methods for taking derivatives and for time stepping. And we achieve small-scale dissipation via a hyperviscosity filter. And so the parameters are chosen in both models to be identical. So while these two models are very similar, there are some key differences. QG3 is two-dimensional. And so we use a grid size of 512 squared. And SPINS is three-dimensional. So we keep the same horizontal resolution, but we also add 512 grid points in the vertical. So the filter in QG3 is applied radially in spectral space, whereas in SPINS, it's applied in X, Y, and Z separately. So there's a small difference in how filtering is achieved. QG3 is not parallelized. So you run it on serial on your desktop, and it takes roughly 10 minutes, whereas SPINS is parallelized using MPI. And we use 64 processors on SharkNet. And the runtime there is about 3 to 5 days. So there's a pretty dramatic increase in computation time. And the reason for that is that SPINS solves 3D equations, first of all, but it can also generate something called gravity waves. The fastest of these gravity waves has a period of 2 pi over n, which, again, using ocean parameters, is about 10 minutes. So to get numerical stability, we cap our time step to 60 seconds. OK, so now let's talk about the results. So we're going to consider an elliptical vortex, which was the first example given by Held's 1995 paper on SQG. So it's given by this asymmetric Gaussian profile. And I should also mention that the domain size is 200 kilometers by 200 kilometers. Okay? So this is basically what the initial conditions look like at the surface. So while SPINS does not have a Rossby number associated with it, right? SQG does not have a Rossby number associated with it. Everything inside of SQG assumes Rossby number equal to 0. We can compute it just for the sake of argument and to compare with SPINS. So given the initial buoyancy field, we have a maximum horizontal velocity of 0.5 meters per second. The width of the vortex is about 100 kilometers. And using typical ocean parameters, so the depth is going to be 1 kilometer, Coriolis frequency 10 to the minus 4, buoyancy frequency 10 to the minus 2. We find a Rossby number of about 0.05. OK, so now I'm going to show you a movie, which hopefully works on this computer. OK, so what we see here is that the vortex rotates anticyclonically, develops filaments. These filaments develop instabilities, which eventually become unstable enough to generate their own sort of separate coherent vortex. So we see a lot of nice small-scale structures. Okay, and so that's great. Right? It looks very similar to the first two pictures I showed you at the start, at the beginning of my talk. However, there is a huge problem here. And that problem is that these small-scale vortices are 10 to 100 times smaller than the original ellipse, which means that the Rossby number is now 10 to 100 times larger. And so therefore, the assumptions of SQG, it's uncertain whether they're still valid in this regime. So now, in order to answer, is SQG still valid here, we're going to look to the SPINS model. We're going to take identical initial conditions from SQG, and we'll vary the Rossby number by changing the strength of rotation. So we have three cases here, and I'm going to start off with the smallest Rossby number. Okay, this is very similar to SQG. It rotates anticyclonically, the filaments form, instabilities are occurring, and we see that there are a lot of small-scale features which are developed. So they're sort of essentially virtually identical. If I increase the Rossby number by a factor of 10, okay, so the first thing we see initially is that the core of the vortex is much more spread out and much more uniform. The filaments still develop. They are a bit thicker. The instabilities are still forming, which is great. However, these instabilities never become energetic enough to form their own separate coherent structures, as we saw in the SQG case. So I'm not sure how good you can see that, but you can see that there's no sort of separate isolated vortices. Okay, and then the last movie I want to show you very quickly is the Rossby number 0.1 case. Here, the core of the vortex is much more spread out. The arms are still developing. They're much wider. However, no instabilities are forming. So in closing, we've seen that SQG can be used to describe large-scale, rapidly rotating ocean and atmospheric flows. And these flows do, in fact, live inside the primitive equations. However, we did talk about the well-known flaw of SQG, and that it's that it generates these small-scale vortices, which potentially do not satisfy the assumptions of the SQG model. And finally, for larger Rossby numbers, we see that the flow is not well described by SQG, and that there's different dynamics occurring, and you need to use the primitive equations to get sort of an accurate description of what's actually happening in the ocean. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
This way,
right. Well, so I mean, if we're talking about two-dimensional fluid, it actually acts quite differently than SQG does. The two-dimensional fluid you can write it in terms of conservation of vorticity. And so what you actually see is this vortex would actually just spin. It would generate the same arms, but these arms would kind of keep going. So SQG is a little bit different in that sense than a two-dimensional fluid. But in terms of, is it surprising that it's generating these small-scale vortices? I mean, I guess not. I mean, you can sort of, from the primitive equations, we do see that this phenomenon does occur, assuming you have a small enough Rossby number. The problem is that the question is, how small does the Rossby number have to be in order for the SQG equations to be sort of accurate for what we're seeing in the primitive equations, right? So what we saw was for the Rossby number 0.05 case, which is what we computed the SQG model was doing, they're very different in terms of how they're acting, right? The small scale vortices aren't being sort of generated from the filament. Does that make sense?
Right, it's just what's expected to happen.
Oh, what's expected to happen. Again, it all depends on the Rossby number, right? Rossby number is very small, then you expect SQG to look like it does. But once you get sort of to the more interesting regime where the Rossby number starts becoming a little bit bigger, then that's sort of, you expect SQG to not really look that way. So, I mean, assuming you're sort of on Jupiter and the Rossby number is very small, I'm sure that you would see sort of identical features to SQG.
I didn't understand why the primitive equations had to be 3D rather than 2D.
So we do use shallow water, but we wanted to use the primitive equations because we figured that we might as well sort of compare the real physics that's actually happening with this model, and so that's why we're using the primitive. That's why we're using the three-dimensional primitive equations. I mean, you could certainly do the same thing with shallow water. However, I think things would be slightly different. I don't know exactly how different it would be. Something just came to mind. So one major difference, so in the shallow water equations, you don't have any vertical motion, whereas in the primitive equations you do, And what you end up finding in the primitive equations is that this SQG ellipse generates these gravity waves, which I didn't have time to show, unfortunately. But that is sort of one thing that happens, is that there is vertical motion in the primitive equations. And so you end up sort of seeing new and interesting dynamics. Yes?
Good question.
Sure.
You mentioned the state function vorticity formulation
yes.
for two-dimensional flows, and it works very well.
Yes.
Have you seen anybody trying to develop that with three-dimensional?
Three-dimensional stream function?
Yes.
I don't think so. I mean, so the whole idea with the stream function is that it automatically satisfies incompressibility, right? So if you have a three-dimensional fluid, you'd have to think of a way to write something that du dx plus dv dy plus dw dz is equal to 0. So in two dimensions, it's quite easy because you just change the order of integration. So in three dimensions, I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard of anything like that. No.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.